Let's go to Acts chapter 1. We're still covering when the New Testament quotes the Old Testament. We finally made it through all the Gospels. We did the black letters and we did the red letters. Now we're going to head into Acts. We'll get the epistles and all those kind of things and just have a good old time. So we begin in Acts chapter 1. And to get our setting, Jesus is met with his apostles. That's a combination of disciples and apostles. He's met with his apostles for 40 days after his resurrection. And so Acts chapter 1 begins on that 40th day. He ascends into the clouds. The 12 watch him go, and then they go back to Jerusalem to wait for what the Father had promised, and which would be the baptism of the Holy Spirit. So they go back to Jerusalem, and then they're meeting together with the 120. There were, you know, a good core of 120, which were still sticking around Jerusalem, still waiting, didn't get the idea that this was over, and didn't go back home to families or anything like that. And so you got about 120 that are there meeting together, and in the midst of them, Peter decides that they need to use their time wisely, and he's a been reading the scriptures, been thinking about it. Possibly this is passed on to him from Jesus, that they needed to get a replacement for Judas. And so we want to pick it up in verse 15, Acts 1:15. It says, "And at this time, Peter stood up in the midst of the brethren, a gathering about 120 persons was there together, and said, 'Brethren, the scripture had to be fulfilled, which the Holy Spirit foretold by the mouth of David concerning Judas, who became a guide to those who arrested Jesus. For he was counted among us and received his portion in this ministry. Now this man acquired a field with the price of his wickedness. And falling headlong, he burst open in the middle and all his bowels gushed out. And it became known to all who were living in Jerusalem, so that in their own language that field was called Hekeldama, that is, field of blood. For it is written in the book of Psalms, let his homestead be made desolate, and let no man dwell in it, and his office let another man take. It is therefore necessary that of the men who have accompanied us all the time that the Lord Jesus went in and out among us, beginning with the immersion of John until the day that he was taken up from us, one of these should become a witness with us of his resurrection.'" So they get the two guys, Joseph, called Barsabbas, also called Justice, and then Matthias. And then they pray, cast the lots, and Jesus chose Matthias. And so he's numbered with the 11, so you got 12 apostles again. Now, what we want to focus on, though, is in verse 20, after that little discussion about Judas and what he did, it says, "For it is written in the book of Psalms, let his homestead be made desolate, and let no man dwell in it, and then his office let another man take." So we got Psalm 69 and Psalm 109. Let's go to Psalm 69 first. "Let his homestead be made desolate and let no man dwell in it." You know, we get a picture from the Gospels. We get a little bit of a picture about Judas. The prophets, and particularly the book of Psalms, gives us an even greater picture about Judas. We can pick up some details about Judas that you don't even get from the Gospels. I mean, in some ways, Judas in the Gospels, you don't get a lot of information. You get one scenario, I guess, one case where you can see his character. Oh, okay, other than the betrayal, obviously, that does tend to reveal his character just a little bit. But you get the deal when Mary comes and anoints Jesus' feet at Simon, I believe it was Simon the Zealot's house. Or not Simon the Zealot, but it was a Simon, a Pharisee. But she comes, anoints his feet with this expensive perfume, and Judas is unhappy about it. And there we find out that he had been pilfering he was the money keeper for them, the treasurer, and he had been pilfering from the money box. And so you get an idea of his character from that. You get the idea also of the fact that he was betraying Jesus for money, that there was a little money motivation going on there. But the prophets actually throw in more details, more just, you know, their prophecies But the New Testament tells us this is about Judas. The places we're going to look at it in Psalm 69 and Psalm 109, they're actually kind of general looking prophecies about enemies in general, in some situations. But knowing what happened in the New Testament, knowing that these things are quoted particularly about Judas, you can be able to get a little bit more detail about what he was like. Okay, so let's get Psalm 69. Just an example of that too was in Zechariah. I don't remember the chapter off the top of my head, but in Zechariah, it actually talks about, when it talks about the betraying him for 30 pieces of silver, that in that it also says, you know, if you're going to give me my money, give me my money. But if not, you know, he was still going to do it. Money wasn't his only motivation. It was a big one, but it wasn't the only one. There were some other things that worked there. Okay, so Psalm 69. And we've got Psalm of David, but we also have several things that we've seen where the New Testament has quoted from Psalm 69, where Jesus quoted from Psalm 69. Prime example, verse 4. Those who hate me without a cause are more than the hairs of my head. Jesus quoted that one just the night that he was betrayed, talking about just in general, those who hated him. So you've got that. You go down a little bit further. Verse 9, for zeal for your house has consumed me. And so you've got that when Jesus cleared out the temple. The disciples remembered this particular verse. And then we get verse 21, Psalm 69:21. They gave me gall for my food, and for my thirst they gave me vinegar to drink. And we know that Jesus actually asked, you know, actually said he was thirsty, and so they gave him vinegar. And we also know they tried to give him gall. But again, these are just things that were being fulfilled. So you've got a lot of prophecies in here about Jesus, and particularly the time frame on it. Most of them are about his death. Okay, let's see, where do I want to pick this up in? He's talking generally about enemies. Let's start at verse 20. Psalm 69:20. Reproach has broken my heart, and I am so sick. And I looked for sympathy, but there was none, and for comforters, but I found none. They also gave me gall for my food, and for my thirst, they gave me vinegar to drink. Just a side note there, that first verse 20, you know, you get an idea then of what Jesus was going through. You know, he looked for sympathy, none. Comforters, none. I mean, he would have appreciated some sympathy and some comforters even in that situation, but there weren't any to be found. And we've talked before about how he was left alone at that point in time. Okay, so then verse 22. It says, may their table before them become a snare, and when they are in peace, may it become a trap. May their eyes grow dim so that they cannot see, and make their loins shake continually. Pour out your indignation on them, and may your burning anger overtake them. May their camp be desolate. May none dwell in their tents. Okay, now notice he's talking in general. I mean, you look at that and you go, that's generally speaking about his enemies. You know, and you could even say, well, that'd be about all those people that kind of opposed him. But Peter recognizes that this is specifically about Judas. So although there could have been some others that this would apply to too, specifically we can kind of lay this at Judas's feet as well. Notice all the things that all the curses that he directs Judas's way. Their table before them become a snare. When their peace, may it become a trap. May their eyes grow dim so they cannot see. Or if we want to switch it, may his table before him become a snare. When he's in peace, may it become a trap. May his eyes grow dim so he cannot see. Make his loins shake continually. Pour out your indignation on him, and may your burning anger overtake him. May his camp be desolate. May none dwell in his tents. Which is what Peter did with that verse, by the way. He applied it to Judas. That the curses that were coming on Judas, bad. Bad stuff. It's not just that little, you know, verse 25, but it's this whole passage. Continue on in verse 26. It says, for they, and here's the reasoning, for they persecuted him whom you yourself have smitten, and they tell of the pain of those whom you have wounded. do add iniquity. Add iniquity to their iniquity, and may they not come into your righteousness. May they be blotted out of the book of life, and may they not be recorded with the righteous." See, the reasoning given, why such a strong curse on Judas? Why so bad? Well, he says, right, comes right down to, because they persecuted him whom you yourself had smitten, and they tell the pain of those whom you have wounded. Throughout history, God at times, even when he would bring discipline upon Israel, the nations around who would rejoice over that would eventually get their due rewards, if you will, or their just rewards. Their comeuppance, right. If you've been following the Bible reading program that Bob's put out, you get to see that as you go through those prophets. The curses or the God's condemnation upon the various nations who rejoiced over Israel's fall. And that's pretty common, is that God, he will do what he's got to do. I mean, he disciplines those whom he needs to discipline. Israel had their things, but not rejoicing over that. Anyone who rejoiced over that, eventually it came around to them too. Which is why we're also told not to rejoice when our enemies stumble. I mean, even Proverbs talks about not rejoicing when your enemies stumble. Romans chapter 12. Flip over there for just a minute, please. Romans chapter 12, let's start from verse 17. It says, "Never pay back evil for evil to anyone. Respect what is right in the sight of all men. If possible, so far as it depends upon you, or depends on you, be at peace with all men. Never take your own revenge, beloved, but leave room for the wrath of God. For it is written, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay,' says the Lord. But if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him a drink. For in so doing, you will heap burning coals upon his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good." You know, pretty much we're told that, you know, even when we have enemies, to leave them up to God, let him be the one to deal with them. But, like I was saying in Proverbs, he says, you know, don't rejoice over it too. When your enemy stumbles, when your enemy falls, do not rejoice. Now, you got lots of Psalms where he's, you know, asking God to pay back his enemies. But in the same sense, when God does, don't rejoice over it. Okay, how much more then in the case of Jesus, where Jesus had done nothing wrong? You know, I'm sure that Judas had his list of perceived wrongs, how he felt that he had been wronged by Jesus. But Jesus had done nothing wrong. And Judas is still, he says he's persecuted him whom you yourself have smitten. That it wasn't just enough, you know, and there would have been others who would have fallen into that. But in this particular situation, he's dealing with Judas. That part of the reason why he received such a firm dealing with was because looking at Jesus, not seeing who he was, not seeing what he was doing, that was positive. Instead, he's persecuting the one, you know, when Jesus is. Probably when Jesus was facing down, coming, you know, face to face with the Pharisees and having his confrontations, Judas is back there going, okay, he's going to get it this time. They're going to get him this time. Oh, man, he got out of it. You know, you kind of get the idea that Judas's attitude for a long time had not been on the right track. And so he was just watching for opportunities for Jesus to stumble. And then he adds to it by the betrayal. Side note with that. Is you've got something I read about it not too terribly long ago about the gospel of Judas. You know, they found the gospel of Judas, you know, and this is the one true account. You know, all the others were messed up. You know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they didn't really know what they were talking about. They were, you know, the rest of the disciples, they were clueless. But Judas, he knew what was going on. And so he was working with Jesus. They had tag teamed on this one. Jesus has actually communicated to Judas exactly what needed to happen. And so Judas was just, he understood the big picture and he was the one that was helping carry this thing out. That's the gospel of Judas. Truly, they did find that somebody actually did write this. Okay. And, you know, I remember back from my Bible college days when they had more time to discuss useless things than to do anything. One of the things that sometimes would become a discussion was what really happened to Judas in the end. You know, it was, you know, those who would defend Judas, and in Bible college you had those who would defend Judas. Those who would defend Judas would say, well, you know, Judas really, in the end, it worked out well. If Judas hadn't done it, then, you know, Jesus wouldn't have been betrayed. He wouldn't have been crucified, and there'd be no salvation for anybody. So Judas, he was actually carrying out the Lord's will. You know, they weren't going quite as far as the gospel of Judas to say that he actually knew that he knew what he was doing, but it all worked out well in the end. So Judas probably, you know, amazing enough, I don't remember if I was personally involved in any or just kind of heard them going on, these debates about whether or not Judas was going to be in heaven. Verse 28. May they be blotted out of the book of life, and may they not be recorded with the righteous. I think that's our answer. You know, did Judas make it to heaven? No. Sorry. Was it necessary for him to do what he did? Yep, somebody had to do it. But as Rick pointed out, there are, you know, plenty of people who are choosing wickedness, and Judas happened to be one of those guys. He received his comeuppance, as Ken so eloquently put it there. So, you know, his name got blotted out, not recorded with the righteous. Even though it was necessary, his motivations, and we'll get a little bit more of that in a minute, but his motivation was that he's persecuting Jesus when he's down. He's kicking him when he's down, basically. So, anybody have any comments on Psalm 69? We're feeling pretty good about this. Nobody's read the Gospel of Judas and thinks that it's good. Okay, good. Okay, let's go to Psalm 109. It's not part of the Apocrypha, but it's another one of the... Do you? Did you read it?
I read a few pages of it. And,
just couldn't go there anymore. I think...
I might take it back out.
Did you read it, Les?
Yeah.
The whole thing. So was my summary of it pretty accurate? Or that was pretty, pretty close. Okay. I haven't actually read it, so I'm glad to hear that I'm right on as far as what it said. But basically, it's not like it's even part of the Apocrypha. It's just they found another one of these little documents. They've actually found tons of these things. I did take a book out of the library once, and I just got like little bits and pieces. If you want to, it's down in the Bozeman Public Library. I can't remember what it's called, but I'm sure you can find it. And it's got a whole bunch of these other things that have been written, other things that they found, other gospels, other books that, you know. One of them that you've got all the different things about how Jesus as a child performing miracles and, you know, getting angry with other kids and striking them dead and all kinds of good stuff. So, you know, fiction's been written for you many, many years. It's not necessarily a new thing, you know. So the Gospel of Judas is just something, I mean, it's old. They found it. That's what it said. Probably not, has absolutely nothing to do with Judas nor written by Judas. Just obviously it wouldn't have been written by Judas because he didn't have time to write anything. So,
most of those Gnostic Gospels that they talk about were written 300 to 600 years after.
Yep. 300 to 600 years would probably be about right. But some of them I think even are a little bit earlier than that. I think you do have a little bit earlier just because you had the Gnostics in there pretty early. I mean, even showing up in this time. But yeah, a lot of them that they come and they get these datings on or whatever. You're right. It is several hundred years later. But okay, let's go to Psalm 109. Another Psalm of David. Another one of those where David has enemies and he wants God to deal with his enemies. But this is where we get our next quote. And, well, we'll just read and you can kind of get an idea of what happens with Judas. Okay, let's start in verse 4. So we can get a little bit of a running start into this. It says, in return for my love, they act as my accusers. But I am in prayer. Thus they have repaid me evil for good and hatred for my love. Appoint a wicked man over him, and let an accuser stand at his right hand. When he is judged, let him come forth guilty, and let his prayer become sin. Let his days be few, let another take his office. And then he keeps going, which we will keep going in a moment. But verse 8 there is where you get, let another take his office. Okay, so that's our little clue that this is, it's in general, it could be about any enemy. I mean, you could just kind of go, okay, this is just David upset about, you know, Absalom or, you know, any number of his enemies. Although David never really had that kind of a desire to curse Absalom. But I mean, it could have been about any number of his enemies. But with Peter's help, we see that this is specifically, this is a prophecy about Judas and Jesus in general, too, because where he says, in return for my love, they act as my accusers. Does that sound interesting there? But I'm in prayer. They've repaid me evil for good, hatred for my love. Yeah, I mean, you get that. Jesus, what did he do? Nothing. He loved, and in return, what did Judas get back to him? Betrayal and accusations. Okay, so let his days be few, let another take his office. Verse 9, let his children be fatherless and his wife a widow. That would be his death. Fancy way of saying let him die, kill him. Let his children wander about and beg and let them seek sustenance far from their ruined homes. Let the creditor seize all that he has and let strangers plunder the product of his labor. Let there be none to extend loving kindness to him, nor any to be gracious to his fatherless children. Let his posterity be cut off. In a following generation, let their name be blotted out. Okay, I'm going to guess that you probably can't find descendants of Judas. You know, as you look through this, you don't really know what happened to, you know, what happened after Judas died. I mean, he went out, he hanged himself, and his bowels gushed out, as Acts 1 told us. Nice, lovely picture there. But he died. And we know that the field gets, you know, what happens with the field. But what happened with Judas? What happened with his family after that? Well, Psalm 109. You know, and you could say, well, this is just the general course that you could expect things to take. Yeah, maybe so. Peter made sure that verse 8 got fulfilled, let another take his office, because they had responsibility for that. The rest of it they left to God. So whether or not God carried this out, I don't know, but it seems like it would be likely. Okay, so he says, let his children wander about and beg. You know, fatherless children, nobody to provide. Let them seek sustenance far from the ruined homes. So you don't get a picture that his family, even after that, things went too well. Let the creditor seize all that he has. Strangers plunder the product of his labor. None extend loving kindness or be gracious to his fatherless children. Let his posterity be cut off. You know, you don't get the idea that necessarily any of Judas's children suddenly decided that they were going to repent and all. You know, and that's, I mean, if you go with God's justice, God lets individuals suffer for their own consequences. But, I mean, they deal with their own sin. Judas's sin was upon himself. However, Judas's character was probably passed down to his children. Something I heard Mr. Wilson say years ago, years and years and years, when I was long ago in Ghana, and that was, children, generally speaking, go the direction that the parents go. And that's, you know, and it was in reference to somebody in particular who can remain anonymous, but it was, you know, and it was things that, I don't know if you've seen it played out, but I have, where you see parents head off in a direction, and quite often the children go that way too because of what they're brought up in. Parents do have a great effect on children. So, you know, you got to trust God in some cases that He put children where they need to be and the families they need to be in. But along with that, you see the direction that things tend to go. So, word to the wise, word to the parents. Your children will probably develop and follow your character as well. maybe I shouldn't. Well, I will betray myself. I learn a lot about parents by working in school. And I'll use Ghana as an example just because, you know, we won't get so close to home. I'm sure it wouldn't be true here. But in Ghana, you could tell children with good habits in school. You look at their parents had the same habits. In Ghana, of course, in Ghana, children with bad habits, you find those same habits in their parents. You know, and unless the parents change their habits, the children, it was hard work to try to get the children to change theirs. So that's why, just a side note, that's why it's so important to work with parents and children when you're dealing the parents and children when you're dealing with the educational ministry, because you're working with the whole family. So back to where we're going here. Verse 14. Let the iniquity of his fathers be remembered. Right. Let the iniquity of his fathers be remembered. Yeah, that's where I'm at. Sorry, I start to read it and I go, no, why already read that? No, I'm just kind of going back and forth. Let the iniquity of his fathers be remembered before the Lord. Do not let the sin of his mother be blotted out. Okay. Let them be before, I guess it's his mom's fault. It's all Judas's mom's fault, right? Be before the Lord continually, that he may cut off their memory from the earth. Because he did not remember to show loving kindness, but persecuted the afflicted and needy man and the despondent in heart to put them to death. Why such strong condemnation upon Judas? Because he did not remember to show loving kindness. And he persecuted the afflicted and needy man. You know, let's get the next verse. He also loved cursing, so it came to him, and he did not delight in blessing, so it was far from him. But he clothed himself with cursing as with his garment, and it entered into his body like water and like oil into his bones. Let it be to him as a garment with which he covers himself and for a belt with which he constantly girds himself. What was Judas really like? I think we get a picture here that is not necessarily a pretty picture. He persecuted the afflicted, needy man, the despondent in heart, to put them to death. Okay, specifically that we can go, okay, that's Jesus. But you look at the rest of it. He clothed himself with cursing as with his garment. Verse 17, he also loved cursing. He did not delight in blessing, so it was far from him. In modern vernacular, today's language, we would say Judas had a bad attitude. He had attitude problems. When he talks about he loved cursing, he did not delight in blessing. And sometimes you'd think that's just absolutely amazing. He could be walking with Jesus 24/7. Was it rain 365, 24/7? Or how do you put that? 24/7, 365? Right. Okay. All the time. He's with Jesus all the time. And yet he still has a bad attitude. It says he loved cursing and did not delight in blessing. How could you be walking with Jesus and not delight in blessing? I mean, the guy that's going around and blessing everybody, his life, everything is just life being poured out of him. And Judas is back there going, mm-hmm. Yeah. He's got a bad attitude. His attitude has affected everything that's coming into him. And so he clothed himself with cursing as with his garment, and it says, and it entered into his body like water and like oil into his bones. It became a part of him. It was who he was. He's the guy that's sitting back there with a bad attitude about everything that's going on. See, attitude is everything. Attitude is everything. Judas, if you know, thank you to David in the Psalms to give us this picture. Otherwise, we might go, oh, he's just a greedy guy. No, he wasn't just a greedy guy. He's a guy with a bad attitude, looking at what's going on, and he's not seeing the good that's going on. He's just seeing everything bad, picking at the bad, and then that's where, with his whole focus there, he's seeing everything Jesus does in a negative light. So this perfume's being poured on it, and he goes, oh, that could be used for the poor. See, everything that he's doing, he's got a negative attitude. He's got a bad attitude. And so, he loved cursing, so what came to him? Curses. He did not delight in blessing, so what was far away from him? Blessings. Gee, we don't want to look too much more at Judas. I might get a little too close to home, huh? See, Judas had a choice. You know, he was justly condemned. You know, his name was blotted out for good reason. Because he chose his attitude. And that's one of the things I appreciate with my wife that she works with our kids on. Is, you know, I'll hear, you know, talking to one of them, said, oh, she'll say, what attitude are you choosing right now? Because attitude is a choice. Now, sometimes she probably needs to talk to me and say, what attitude are you choosing right now? You know, and maybe as adults, I'm sure that we never need anybody to tell us that we, you know, remind us of what attitude we're choosing. But yeah, see, that attitude is a choice. Judas made his choice about his attitude in the absolute best circumstances. In a case where he had a leader who was without sin. Now let me ask you a question. Can you say that the leadership of the congregation here is without sin? I mean, I'd say that most of the guys are trying to be righteous and some are doing a really good job. But you can't say that they've never been without sin. Judas could develop a bad attitude even with a perfect leader. So is it possible that people could develop bad attitudes with leaders who are less than perfect? In that sense, yeah. Let's not go into a whole discussion of we are perfect because, you know, the imputed perfection and the practicing perfection. And let's not go there. I mean, we know that, yes, we are perfect, but could somebody? Yeah. You had 11 guys who chose good attitudes. Came down to attitude. Did they go through the same struggles? I mean, I've talked before about how is it that Judas could have developed such an attitude. Jesus lived a hard lifestyle. I mean, you're moving with Jesus 24/7. He lived a hard lifestyle. He pushed hard. And you're with him. You know, there are times when he's going days without food. And guess what? If you're with him, you're going days without food. You know, there are times, you know, I have to wonder sometimes. Jesus is up on the mountain. He's teaching. And he says, wow, you know, we've been here for 3 days and they didn't come prepared for this. You know, I have to wonder if those disciples at times are going, oh, you know, they got the little rumbling and their tumblings going on too. They're hungry. And so what's being enjoyed? You know, are the disciples enjoying the teaching of Jesus? Apparently Judas wasn't. So it is a choice. Now, like I said, it's encouraging that 11 out of the 12 chose a good attitude in hard circumstances. And they've received great reward for it. One guy chose a bad attitude. And he got his repayment. I don't think God has necessarily changed over 2,000 years. I think it's going to be the same way. So it all comes back, with Judas, it all comes back to attitude. He chose an attitude that led him down some bad paths. We have a choice over our attitude. What path are we going to go down? Anybody have any final thoughts on Judas? I've done such a good job of covering that we don't have any. Oh. Thanks, Mom. Okay, let's go back then. Let's go over to Acts chapter 2. If nobody has anything more on that, then we'll go on to Acts chapter 2. Acts chapter 2, you've got the day of Pentecost. They've got their 12th guy now. Matthias is there. Day of Pentecost comes, and amazing things happen. They're in the temple, the apostles, the 12 are in the temple. On the day of Pentecost, you have signs happening. Sound like a mighty rushing wind. Not that there was a rushing wind, there was just the sound. So everybody's looking around trying to figure out, what's going on here? And about that time, they see these guys with something like fire over their heads. And so they tend to go check that out. They can make the connection. Sound, fire, strange things going on. This is the place to go. So they gather around the apostles and they hear the 12 speaking with other languages. And they hear them in the language to which they were born. And so it was in their own personal dialect. Now, sometimes in America, that's a little bit more difficult for us, although it's getting easier. It's getting easier. We're getting enough international flavor in Bozeman these days that you get to hear some other languages going on. But you ever decide to stop in New York City, there's a 90% chance, and this is just my estimate, so don't quote me on this one, there's a 90% chance that you're not going to be hearing English. I mean, it's about that bad. I've walked in downtown New York, and you got just I felt like I was in Ghana again. You just had languages going on all around you. So, anyway, so they're all hearing them in their own personal language, the dialect to which they were born. And amazingly, even in that, an amazing sign like that, and still you've got some people are looking at it and going, wow, what's this mean? This has got to mean something. Others are going, they're drunk. I'm sorry. I get drunk. I don't think that I'm going to be speaking fluent Spanish. I just don't think that it's going to happen. But somehow people could look at it and look at a good thing and still come up with something stupid out of it. Verse 14, though. Peter, taking his stand with the 11, that's how we know it's the 12 that were there, raised his voice and declared to them, "Men of Judea and all you who live in Jerusalem, let this be known to you and give heed to my words. For these men are not drunk as you suppose, for it's only the third hour of the day." They're not going to get drunk till later. No, that's not what he's saying. Okay, so it's only the third hour of the day. It says, "But this is what was spoken of through the prophet Joel. And it shall be in the last days, God says, that I will pour forth of my spirit upon all mankind. Your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams. Even upon my bondslaves, both men and women, I will in those days pour forth of my spirit, and they shall prophesy. And I will grant wonders in the sky above, signs on the earth beneath, blood and fire and vapor of smoke. The sun shall be turned into darkness, the moon into blood, before the great and glorious day of the Lord shall come. And it shall be that everyone who calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved." Okay, so Peter said on the day of Pentecost that in the last days, and we must be in the last days about now, so God's going to pour forth the Spirit on all mankind, sons and daughters are going to prophesy, so we should see everybody prophesying, young men having visions and old men dreaming dreams, and because this is the last days. Some of you are smiling, so I know that you're at least catching it, and you're going, okay, he's joking, or else we're going to have to really straighten this guy out. okay. That was the more common take on that. This is prophesied in Joel. So let's go back to Joel. Joel chapter 2. Joel 2:28, and this is where you get that quote. Okay, it says, "It will come about after this that I will pour out my spirit on all mankind." And you've got some other prophecies there about the Assyrians and stuff. It says, "It will come about after this time, after this, that I'll pour out my spirit on all mankind, and your sons and your daughters will prophesy, your old men will dream dreams, your young men will see visions, and even on the male and female servants, I'll pour out my spirit in those days, and I'll display wonders in the sky and on the earth, blood, fire, columns of smoke. The sun will be turned into darkness, the moon into blood before the great and awesome day of the Lord comes. And it will come about that whoever calls on the name of the Lord will be delivered. For on Mount Zion in Jerusalem, there will be those who escape, as the Lord has said, even among the survivors whom the Lord calls." Okay. In our quote, this is coming from Joel. Joel, I'm thinking, is somewhere, let's say roughly 800 years before Jesus. It's kind of a hard to place I think it's probably somewhere around 800 years, because I think a lot of what you got in here is referring to the Assyrians. But whatever the case, he says it will come about after this. Now in Acts, he said it will come about in the last days. Here it says, after this. So Joel, written several hundred years before the book of Acts, before the stuff that's happening on the day of Pentecost, says, after this, there's going to be a time when I'll pour out my spirit on all mankind, your sons, your daughters will prophesy. Okay, so you don't get a specific time frame from Joel as to when that's going to happen. So we got to figure out what is being spoken of when he talks about in the last days. So go over to Hebrews, please. Chapter 1. Hebrews chapter 1. We're going to start from verse 1. God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets in many portions and in many ways, in these last days has spoken to us in his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the world. And he goes on. And he is the radiance of his glory. Okay. It says, long ago God spoke, he said, to the fathers in the prophets in many portions and in many ways. God used a whole bunch of different ways to speak during the times of the prophets. He says, but in these last days, he's spoken to us in his Son. Okay. The writer of Hebrews at that point in time referred to his time as these last days. So, and that the communication from God was taking place through Jesus. Okay. In these last days. So he defines the last days as having started way back then. So you have the previous times when God was using fathers and prophets in many portions, many ways, and then the last days is through Jesus. Now, another verse to go with it. Go over to James. James chapter 5. James chapter 5, verse 1. He says, come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries which are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted and your garments have become moth-eaten. Your gold and your silver have rusted, and their rust will be a witness against you and will consume your flesh like fire. It is in the last days that you have stored up your treasure. Okay, James addressing the rich at that time. says, it is in the last days that you have stored up your treasure. He referred to that time as the last days. So, from the perspective of the New Testament writers, the last days were then. They were in the last days. You can go back, and it's an interesting study if you get so inclined, and look in the Old Testament at the times when they talk about the last days. In that case, they're always talking about the last days, something that, referring to a future event. When you get Hebrews, you get James, he talks about in the last days, and he refers to it as that specific time that they were in right then. So I guess maybe we must be in the last hours of the last day. Now, to be consistent, let's check out a couple other places before we wind up here that talk about the last days that often people use to apply to future. These two places here, most people will overlook those. If you're talking with them about last days, they won't think about Hebrews chapter 1. They won't think about James chapter 5. They will think about 2 Timothy chapter 3. But once you get it defined from Hebrews and James, it'll help other things click. Once you start figuring out that the last days are beginning all the way back there from the time that God began speaking through His Son, that was the beginning of the last days, then, yeah, you can say, yeah, we're still in the last days, but the last days have been going on for quite a while. Okay. 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 1. He says, "But realize this, that in the last days difficult times will come. For men will be lovers of self, lovers of money, boastful, arrogant, revilers, disobedient to parents, ungrateful, unholy, unloving, irreconcilable, malicious gossips, without self-control, brutal, haters of good, treacherous, reckless, conceited, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, holding to a form of godliness, although they have denied its power, and avoid such men as these." Okay, now, first of all, in the last days, difficult times will come. And so a lot of times people will look at this here and go, see, we are in the last days now. And they will come straight to this verse. We are in the last days right now. Look, men will be lovers of self. Are men lovers of self today? Oh, yeah. Lovers of money. Do we have men who are lovers of money? Yes. Boastful, arrogant. Yes. Just look at our president-elect if you want to see arrogance. Disobedient to parents. Do we have children who are disobedient to parents today? Nah. But you go through the whole list and people go, yeah, that's today. That perfectly describes today. Well, we happen to live today, so maybe that's why we think that it perfectly describes today. But do you think it could have perfectly described the first century as well? Do you think that there weren't lovers of self in the first century? Lovers of pleasure. The dark ages. Good point. Right. Right. Those are some pretty bad times too. See, you've got bad times have happened. I don't know, that disobedient to parents, I think that's a new thing though. I think children used to always be obedient to parents. Or they died, but holding to a form of godliness, although they've denied its power. I believe those were what Jeff was referring to earlier as Gnostics. And avoid such men as these. I guess they had such men like that back then, too. See, the last days, people look at that and at first they go, realize this, that in the last days, everyone likes to think, oh, we're in the last days. Okay, yeah. So were they, a couple centuries ago, a couple millennium ago, they were in the last days as well. And yes, this did describe them just as well as it describes us today. Go over to 2 Peter, please, chapter 3. So what we'll finish up on here this morning. Yeah. 2 Peter chapter 3. Verse 3. Know this first of all, that in the last days, mockers will come with their mocking, following after their own lusts, and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For ever since the fathers fell asleep, all continues just as it was from the beginning of creation. For when they maintain this, it escapes their notice that by the word of God, the heavens existed long ago, and the earth was formed out of water and by water, through which the world at that time was destroyed, being flooded with water. Okay, that is uniformitarianism. Isn't that a nice word? But that's what that theory is there, that everything continues just as it has from the beginning. Uniformitarianism. Do you think uniformitarianism is a new thing? You think it just came with the theory of evolution? And that everything, you know, you think that's new? No. They've had it. There, you had people saying the same thing. The mockers were there with their mocking back then, following after their own lusts. So when it says that in the last days mockers will come with their mocking, just because they're mocking today doesn't mean they weren't mocking then. And just side note, totally off, that gives you a little insight into Revelation as well. That Revelation may not be, as so many people tend to think, a chronology of things, but maybe just a general description of how people have been and are and will continue to be until the end. Okay, that's a freebie side note for you to ponder over at the very end. But the last days in Acts chapter 1, Peter's using the last days even to refer to his time right then. So the last days began back then. And so the things that he's talking about are applying to what's going on right then, right there. And we'll continue from there next week.